Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And now, the list of things that you can buy at the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com. Things to wear like Chicago Reader hats, t-shirts, bandanas, and face masks. Things for your daily life like the Chicago Reader camping mug, Chicago Reader tote bags, and a Chicago Reader reporter's notebook. Things for you to read like our Reader recipes, the Chicago Reader 420 Companion, our Chicago Reader Best Of book series from journalists Maya Duke-Masaba, Mike Sula, Ben Jarofsky, and Lior Galil, the Chicago Reader coloring book, and the Chicago Reader Stay Home puzzle. Find the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com and show your support for the nation's first free weekly newspaper since 1971.
Bonus time in the Ben Jarofsky Show as I speak. It's Friday, April 19th, 2024. I have a distinguished guest awaiting. And as I always do, I like to give you a sense of what's in the news as I begin this conversation. So I'll give you a sense of what's in the news. That it's not something I learned about in the newspaper. It's not something I learned about on Instagram. It's not something I learned about on the TV or radio, what have you. It was a text message I received from our very own distinguished guest today, alerting me to the fact that a name I hadn't thought about in a while, of a Chicago legend, political legend, had died. The Walter Slim Coleman. And the reason I say Walter is because that's part of the story of Slim Coleman in Chicago, is sort of the evolution, if you will, of Slim Coleman into a public figure that was very, his heyday, I guess, would have been in the late 70s, early 80s, during the Harold Washington years. He just died a little while ago. And there was one moment in particular that I happened to witness. I did not know Slim Coleman, but it deals with an almost fight he got into with Alderman Eddie Brdoek on the floor of the Chicago City Council. Back in the day in the 80s, ladies and gentlemen, I actually left my house from time to time, and I wasn't just hanging out in the attic. Looking out the window, thinking great thoughts, but I actually went to the Chicago City Council, and I was there that day. I'm like, watch that moment in just kind of disbelief at the spectacle of two very well-known Chicagoans threatening to go at it, put your dukes up. So anyway, I'm ready to take a mini deep dive on Slim Coleman, at least start off talking Slim Coleman. And here's the subhead. The demonization of Chicago radicals. How's that for a subhead that just popped into my mind? So without further ado, I'm going to ask my distinguished guest to introduce himself, the author, the aforementioned text obituary of Slim Coleman. Introduce yourself.
Hi, Ben. It's Brendan Schiller. For the last year and a half or so, you've called me a poker player. But truth is, I've been back in Chicago for almost 2 months now doing policy and consulting, and I'll be in Vegas for the World Series of Poker, but I'm more Chicagoan again these days. So we'll introduce myself as a Chicagoan activist.
Okay, Chicagoan activist. He is a rabble-rouser sometimes, a lawyer other times, a political observer other times, a political insider other times. And every now and then he jets off to Vegas and he plays poker. What a life, the Brendan Schiller story. You're also the son of Helen Schiller, the former alderwoman of the 46th Ward. And it was growing up with Helen Schiller and her allies that you learned really everything you know, or most of what you know about Chicago politics. And one of her key allies was Slim Coleman. So I guess you're in a pretty good position because you literally came of age around Slim and Helen and the whole group of activists in Uptown to sort of tell the story of Slim Coleman and sort of.
Yeah. So
go ahead.
Slim Coleman was in a Texas conservative family, upper middle class white family in Lubbock, Texas. But he was into music. He didn't discriminate where he went and listened to music. And he didn't discriminate necessarily with the people he liked hanging out with, including women who were also into music. And he found himself at some almost all black concerts in Dallas and Houston in the late 50s and early 60s as a teenager. And he got radicalized. He was a really smart guy. He got radicalized by those folks. He dropped out of Harvard University a month before his graduation and started working for James Forman at SNCC, at the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, where he met Kathy Archibald. And the two of them eventually moved to Chicago because this may have been true in other major cities, I don't know. But in Chicago, even though Chicago is known for its segregation, in the 60s and 70s, it had several pockets of poor whites living near, at least, other pockets of poor Latinos and poor blacks, including in Lincoln Park, parts of the West Side, parts of the North Lakefront, like Uptown. And so they thought that that would be a good organizing opportunity. When SNCC dissolved, Slim went was an activist over at SDS, Students for Democratic Society, which is kind of like the folks who try to figure out how to be anti-war, but also the participatory democracy, not being anarchist, but including everybody without a hierarchical structure. Some of the stuff that kind of predates some of the police abolitionist activists currently. There was a big blow up. So SDS at the time was located a block away from the Black Panther Party and headquarters on the West Side. And that's where Slim met Fred Hampton. And they became friends. And then there was a blow up at SDS that Slim led, in part because of he viewed them as acting in a racist manner. And eventually what happened was Slim set up shop in Uptown and created the Intercommunal Survival Collective of the Black Panther Party, which was a bunch of radical white folks in Uptown organizing the poor white folks in Uptown under the banner of the Black Panther Party. And he recruited 30 or 40 other white radicals from across the country, including my mother, to come to Uptown and organize and do various survival programs, some of which have had a lasting legacy. To this day, one of them is the Uptown People's Law Center, which is ran and operated by Alan Mills. There was the Uptown People's Learning Center. There was clinics. There was colleges. There was schools. There was all sorts of programming that had an impact for 30 or 40 years after that.
Let's just pause and think about something you just said. White activists in Uptown organizing poor whites under the banner of the Black Panther Party. Wow, man. My mind is blown. It's just everything in that sentence is just seems to a contradiction. And just to set the chronological time here, Slim Coleman was born in the 1940s. I think 43, if I'm doing this correctly. He died of cancer at age 80 just recently. But just think about this. This is roughly 1969 that Brendan is talking about. So Slim Coleman would have been 26 years old. So a lot of you listening to this weren't even born then. Brendan wasn't even born then. So it's a long ago time. But it was there was a certain amount of idealism in the world that existed at that time. Brought on by activism against the Vietnam War and for civil rights for black people. And so it was possible to utter a statement. White activists organizing poor white people under the banner of the Black Panther Party. Take the deep dive in that, Brendan, a little bit. Go ahead.
Yeah, so, I mean, I wasn't even born. But my impression is, because you had an era where white power, literal actual white power, was so violently fighting against the civil rights movement during the 60s, including with assassinations and mass violence against black folks. But also, you had simultaneously a situation where middle class and lower middle class white folks felt the insecurity of the draft and therefore could be empathetic to some of the insecurities of black folks. That was a unique time to be able to radicalize some white folks, a time which probably hasn't existed since, because without the draft, none of those white folks would have felt that insecurity and would have been empathetic and would have been radicalized. So you had a large percentage than you would normally get of middle class, lower middle class, educated, semi-educated white folks being radicalized and therefore opening their eyes to the power, to the racial, to, you know, white supremacy and patriarchy and all those things, and the impact of capitalism through the lens of white supremacy. And so that's why, not just in Chicago, but elsewhere, you probably had these groups of, that's why you had SDS and Weathermen and the Chicago 7 and all that. This was a unique group of folks who showed up in Uptown because they really wanted to, they had a deep analysis of white supremacy and the impact and the need to operate under organizations fighting for black liberation. And so that's what they did. You know, the other thing that has happened over the last 50, 60 years, not to get too far afield, is major U.S. cities did have broad pockets of white poverty. The combination of gentrification and 50 years of neoliberal economic policy and the continued stratification by race of economic opportunity has meant that all white poverty is now rural. So there is no urban white poverty. And so the opportunity to organize white folks based on economic and power issues under the banner of black liberation existed not only in unique geographies, but in a unique period of time where there was some proximity to those folks. Now there's no proximity. I don't know what the point of that is, but the combination of the draft creating insecurity for educated middle-class and lower middle-class white folks and the proximity of poor white people to poor black and Latino people in major cities allowed for a unique period in history where that could occur.
Thank you for mentioning the draft. It's one of my favorite themes and topics as I reflect upon the universe that existed when I was young and the universe that exists now. And I probably said that, I've said this many times on the mic, and I probably said it to you. And that is, nothing turned white people to conservatives more, and I'm speaking of my generation of baby boomers, which is a pretty worthless generation, but nothing turned white people into conservatives more than getting rid of the draft. So all these white people, man, when they were subjected to the draft and were worried about going to Vietnam, they were the biggest activists in the world. And they were like exploring all kinds of themes of racism and poverty and equity. And they wanted to like radically change the system so it was fair. And then as soon as the draft ended and they didn't have to worry about going to Vietnam or going to the army anymore, all of a sudden they drifted to conservatives in 1980. They're voting for Ronald Reagan. They're like, well, you know, I've evolved. Yeah, you've evolved. All right. You're no longer subjected to the draft and your kids won't be subjected to the draft. That's how you evolve. But here's the point. Slim Coleman, Helen Schiller had never had to worry about the draft. But all those Slim Coleman's allies in Uptown, they never drifted. They never drifted. Even when the draft wasn't a reality that they had to worry about, Brendan, they never drifted. They never like embraced Reagan in 1980. Go ahead.
Some of them may have drifted a little bit in and out, but there was some really strong leadership who had by that time had built really good, deep relationships with black and Latino activists, black and brown, Latino and Asian and activists across the city, and had developed some a really deep theoretical analysis of the political power dynamics and understood things. And so that leadership stayed strong. And they were also, at that point, engaged in real institutions doing real work, like the Chicago Area Black Lung Association, like Justice Graphics, which was tied to these political operations throughout the city. And there was nonstop electoral political activity, essentially from the summer of 1972, when the campaign to oust Edward Hanrahan, the mastermind of the Fred Hampton assassination, occurred, all the way through Harold Washington's election in 83, both in the city and in the war. There was basically an election almost every year, if you remember, because it was the remap. There was, who was the 17th Ward guy? There was the, I'm telling you stuff from when I'm a little kid. There was the Alan Streeter stuff in the city. But, you know, Daley had passed. There was Byrne. And then in the ward, there was five aldermanic races between 1974 and 1979. So they were just busy doing the work. And it was really actually kind of an exciting time, because that 15 years, not just in Chicago, but across the major cities across the country where there was black pluralities, that 15 years following the Voting Rights Act and Civil Rights Act saw real energy around electoral politics, because there appeared to be the first time ever that you could have actual political power. So that's when you really were getting 89-90% turnout in black communities, because there was still hope. And so it was just... There was a lot of reasons, I think, why they stuck to it. But
go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. Finish your thought.
I know where you wanted to go is, but the result was, because they stuck to it, there was real demonization, because it was real demonization of Slim in the 80s and the people around it, because it was like, okay, there's no draft, but 10 years later, why are y'all still fighting this fight? What's the problem? Where's the contract? What contract do we need to get you? There was a lack of understanding from the political power structure why educated white folks who could clearly go make a bunch of money were still being activists in Uptown.
Yes.
Yeah.
And not only being activists in Uptown, but directing their efforts to local politics, which is an interesting development too, because so much of the anti-war movement was like these global things, and the war itself in Vietnam, foreign policy in general, civil rights in general, national legislation. You just named like three or four significant political uprisings in Chicago that were very local. Like the 17th Ward, it's extremely local. And so Slim Coleman channeled like all of his left-wing ideology or philosophy or worldview or have you into local Chicago politics. And that was a challenge for the powers that be in the city, because here was a white guy who went to Harvard. So he was clearly smart. He clearly could have been a corporate lawyer or a money man. He could have been one of them very easily, all right? And he chose to go to the left, and he chose to organize poor white people. And then as the neighborhood began to gentrify, he connected those white people to black people in Chicago, into a larger political struggle that led to Harold Washington. And it's like, if you're the power that be in Chicago, if you're just a member of a corporate law firm, that kind of irritate the hell out of you. It's like, he's making me look bad. I sold out.
So to be clear, the focus on local politics really did come from the party, the Black Panther Party. It was Huey Newton and Elaine Brown and them announced that focus. They did it in Oakland, trying to take over the port of Oakland. But that was a big thing that came from them. But I don't think power folks were looking at Slim and saying, I sold out. They're looking at Slim and saying, why is he giving us such a hard time? We're trying to control the power and money here, and he's making us spend more money and more energy to control the power and money than we want to.
Yeah. Fair enough. I don't know. I don't know what's going on in the depth of their minds, okay? I guess I did I took a deep dive into their minds. Why isn't he sold out like me? So what the first thing they do, the demonization of an activist in Chicago, to say you're a fraud and you're a phony. You're not who you say you are. And so with the case of Slim Coleman, what they do is go back to his roots, and they'll say, you know, he says his name is Slim. He's not. That would make, and this is there was this Mike Royko column. I don't know if you ever read it, about his fight in City Hall. We'll get into the fight in a little bit. His name is not Slim. It's Walter. It's like that bit. The only rap thing I know is the Eminem movie, 8 Mile. Did you ever see that movie?
Or are you?
Okay. So, and at the end, the culminating scene is where this showdown where Eminem is rapping against some other guy. I can't remember, ladies and gentlemen. I saw it once and I don't know anything about rap or hip hop. But at the end, he goes, I know the secret about you. Your name is Clarence and you have two parents. Look at that. I just did it. And he's pointing out, and then the whole crowd goes, whoa, what a put down. He's not really from the streets. He's a phony. His name is Clarence. He has two parents and he goes to a private school. The private school he went to, by the way, is the same one that Chris Webber went to. I just want to point that out. Anyway, neither here nor there. That's the first thing. The Chicago political establishment was Eminem before Eminem, and they called out Slim Coleman. His real name is Walter. I know about you. You went to Harvard. You're not really a poor Appalachian white in Uptown. You're a Harvard grad from a rich family. That's what they did. You know, you don't see that. No opit said that, Brendan, but that's what they did to trivialize, marginalize. Go ahead.
I mean, I think we had this conversation in a different context about a year ago, but the first attack from the establishment on anybody on the left is actually always both a projection and then a really specious false equivalency attack implying hypocrisy that doesn't exist. So the projection is, this person has to be doing this for money because I would be doing it for money or power. This can't be out of the goodness of their heart or principles or belief. This has to be. And in this world, in this cynical world that's run by the cynicism of Trump and MAGA now in terms of creating the lens by which everybody views things, it's even more that way. But that's the projection. And so if there's a projection that there has to be something about this person that they're hiding, it's really more about power or money or something that they're not telling. It can't be based, it can't be this transparently based on principle, then there has to be some hypocrisy in what they're doing. I'm going to find it. And they always come up with these really petty, false, specious hypocrisies that aren't actually hypocrisies, right? And sometimes what they show is a growth and evolution in a person, but it's so silly. And when we had this conversation a year ago, we were talking about these false hypocrisies that are really just projections. I forget the context, but you had gone out to dinner with a couple people, and they had accused you of being a hypocrite because you were like went to Bulls games or something.
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah, what a memory you have. Yes. Oh, my goodness. Go ahead. Go finish your thought. Now
that's what I'm saying. It's like they think because you operate on principle and you believe in economic and equality and racial equality that somehow that means you're not supposed to have your own life. It's a bizarre view of what being principle means because they're so enamored with their own self-interest.
Yes. Thank you for that. I didn't know where you were going. Like, as I told you, I do so many of these shows a week. And then when I'm not doing these shows, I'm talking to the people who are going to do the shows with. So I've already talked to Brendan, for instance, today for like 20 minutes. So Brendan's always reminding me of conversations we had. And when he begins that, I'm like, okay, this sounds like something I said. I have no memory of saying it. Did I say it to Brendan? Was it something I said to somebody else? And yes, now it's coming back. What a incredible memory you have. Clearly, you didn't smoke as much cannabis as I did back in the 80s. So the 70s, actually. So yes, it was these two, I won't name them, two officials who were allies of Mayor Rahm. and they were making fun of me because I go to Bulls games. Because I asked for what the special was at the restaurant we were at. I go, what's the special? They go, oh, look at the lefty getting the special. And I go, what am I supposed to live in poverty? Because, you know, you're the only one who gets to enjoy the special because you've sold out to Mayor Rahm. Is that the how? Once I've sold out to Mayor Rahm, do I get to eat this? Anyway, it was a very similar thing with
it's a really narrow understanding of what progressive politics is, because they constantly operate from their own self-interest. And they think if you don't operate from your own self-interest, you're not supposed to demand your value. When actually leftist politics is, we want to demand our value and value for everybody else who's got humanity and has some dignity, but whatever.
So you are sort of involved in one of the most, most publicized moments of Slim Coleman's career in the early 80s. So Slim Coleman formed an alliance with Harold Washington and organized on behalf of Harold Washington in the 1983 election and helped contribute to Washington's victory. Listen, that victory was mostly black people. Let's not get it twisted. 99% black people, but there was enough white people that voted for Harold that he was able to beat Bernie Epton. And so the efforts of people like George Adkins, and Slim Coleman, and Helen Schiller, and Curly Cohen, and Mark Zalkin in Uptown was significant. All right. And Charlotte Neufeld, give her a shout out as well, even though she wasn't part of your group, but she was doing work for Harold in the. And he became an ally of Washington. And as such, he was sort of publicly identified as Harold Washington, one of Harold Washington's most best known white allies. There weren't a lot of them back in those days, Brendan. So, and Slim was one of the best known ones. And he was prominently featured in articles in the newspaper. He was known by the media. And the media was constantly fed. And I could tell you this because I was a young reporter in Chicago, that constantly fed propaganda from the Burke-Verdoliak forces intending to marginalize Slim Coleman and Helen Schiller and all their allies along the lines of everything that Brendan was talking about, on top of which they were like the whispers of all kinds of bizarre, twisted, weird sexual deviancies, which were really just like the fantasies of the people doing the whispering. But the intention of doing all this stuff is to turn reporters against these leftist figures. And it hasn't changed, ladies and gentlemen, in 40 years. They're still whispering little nothings in the reporters' ears. This guy is secretly a drunk. This guy secretly plays around on his wife. This guy, if it ever comes out, what this guy is doing, the beating up women. I've heard everything, Brendan, whispered into my ear over the years. And I'm like, if you got the goods, bring the goods out. Don't whisper in my ear. Show me the police report. All you're trying to do is turn me against somebody. You follow? It's like a weird psychological game you're playing. If you got the goods, deliver the goods. That's my attitude. That is my attitude. So that was what was going on. That's why I always say it was feeding time in the press office in the early 80s. Ed Burke would open up the door to the City Hall press office, and the reporters were like seals, and he would throw raw fish at them, and they would just eat them as they flew in the air. That's what it was like, ladies and gentlemen. You all been brainwashed. Anyway, that's the introduction to Slim Coleman's encounter with Eddie Verdoliak on the floor of the Chicago City Council. I was there, but Brendan, you were closer to it all. You were like in the middle of it in many ways, even though you were just a young lad of 12 or whatever you were. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I think we discussed this story once before on the show, and it's in my mother's book. But, you know, if you're white radicals in a poor white neighborhood organizing in Chicago in the 70s and 80s, you're going to be organizing and coming up against neo-Nazi and racist gangs. And there was a gang in Uptown called the Rebels, which was being fed by the cops, being fed monetarily by the cops, by the alderman of that period's chief of staff, who was a known FBI operative, and by a Michigan KKK operation. They were all providing resources to this group. This group recruited Kevin Zorn. So the Zorn's family was an impoverished Appalachian family, anti-racist family, very large, that moved to Uptown. And, apart from all these radical educated whites, this was a poor, large, anti-racist Appalachian family that had moved around and operated in Uptown in the 60s and 70s. One of the kids was Kevin Zorn's. The rebels had recruited Kevin. The reason you referenced me is the guy, Kevin Zorn's ended up being killed. The guy who killed Kevin Zorn's, his name was Jerry Shields. He had pulled a gun on me when I was 12 and told me not to be in a certain area of Uptown with black folks. He used the N-word when he said it. So I think that's what you're referencing. It came up again recently because when this was going on, I spent a couple months hanging out with the Klonskys, Michael and Susan Klonsky. I think when Susan was actually pregnant with Jennifer Klonsky, and that was, I guess you could say I was hiding out in Florida with them while all this was happening. But then, obviously, I'm in Florida. Kevin Zorns is not. Kevin Zorns gets killed in a low income, a white, predominantly white, low income building in Uptown. By Jerry Shields. And then Zorns was a kid to this large, progressive Appalachian family. And so the services happened at the Heart of Uptown Coalition, and the mayor Mayor Washington came to the services. And then at some meeting in the summer of, I think, of 84, 85, some city council meeting where the mayor's trying to still fighting council wars and trying to get something passed, and they may be able to get it passed. Verdoliak is a pure political tool, maneuver to delay it and to distract from it, calls Slim the caretaker or something of the Nazi party, and Slim is because at the time had all Chicago City News and Justice Graphics was part of the media, had media press, was in the media section, probably hanging out with, two spots down from you, right next to a young Fran Spielman and a young John Cass or whatever, and jumped the thing, pretend like he was going to fight for Doliak, pretend like they were going to fight. There's a bunch of security and cops around the state council. It was all show. But that's the background story.
Yeah, no, he called them the Verdoliak called Slim Coleman, the funeral director for the Nazi party, and the funeral director for the Nazi party, and then Slim Coleman said, "I'll get you," and he hopped over the railing, he tried to, and he was held back, and everybody had a field day with it. Mike Royko wrote a column, which you can still read. And you can see it's actually, I encourage everybody to read, because it gives you a sense of everything we've been talking about.
We're like 30 minutes into this, and it's a lot of fun talking about the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and it's really historical. But it cannot go unsaid that Slim's, I think, longest lasting legacy is going to be one of his daughters. I think Tanya Lozano is now the leader at the church that Slim and Emma founded 15 years ago or whatever, in Pilsen. It's now in Pilsen. It was originally found in Humble Park at Damon at 22nd Street. And Tanya and her husband are the primary leaders. And they have, I think, created the most interesting, robust, dynamic church in the city that has a congregation that's almost entirely under the age of 30. And if you go there on any given Sunday, you're going to see a multi-denominational, multi-generational full of vibrancy, spiritual experience that includes a couple hundred young people. And I don't know if there's any church of any denomination in the city doing that. Long after Uptown, when Slim began to focus, you know, Slim married Emma and they had their two children, Jolene and Tanya, and Slim began to focus on immigration justice. We could go on for another hour just talking about the last 20 years of his impact on that. But I think in 10, 15 years, everybody in the city is going to know who Tiny Lozano is.
No.
I didn't want to go too far.
No, that's good. That was a good riff. And we'll close this chapter. I intentionally chose to focus on the part I did because I wanted to tell a larger story about what happens when people challenge the system in this city that game is still being played to a certain degree or another. Slim Coleman moved on with his life, became a reverend, he became a leader. He and his wife and his whole family became a leader in the movement for immigrant rights, migrant rights. We could just transition right now into the other part of the conversation that we wanted to have to update it, the way immigration is being used today, politically speaking. One of the most insidious and devious, we talk about it all the time on this show, Brendan, but one of the most insidious and devious techniques of the MAGA movement is how they're trying to pick a fight between black community and the Hispanic community. I see it happening here in the city of Chicago. I see it happening in the city council. I see it happening on a national level. If Donald Trump is going to prevail, it'll be one of the reasons that he successfully prevails. There's many factors, obviously, in Donald Trump's election. There's many things he's trying to exploit, but this is definitely one of them. And that is this notion that if you, in any way, as a society, help immigrants who've come here from across the border, from Mexico or Venezuela or what have you, you're somehow or other not helping black people. And that has been positioned in this city, definitely since Brandon Johnson has been elected mayor. It's just an ongoing chorus that I hear from the city council. And part of it, I believe, Brendan, you've heard me say this, is a failure on the part of the Democratic Party to show that you can help immigrants and help black people at the same time. And you should put black people to work helping immigrants and then create jobs out of that. It's a failure to the Democratic Party. They don't want to go in that direction. They want to go in whatever direction they're going in. But that's where we're at right now. And I frankly don't know how the Democrats are going to get out of this because they're afraid to confront it directly, in my humble opinion. Your thoughts?
One, I agree. There is we on the left and political operatives and the Democratic Party and other folks continually fail to explain how government money and money in general that society produces is not a zero-sum game. It's being played out right now in the city of Chicago as it relates to the $70 million migrant package. There is a real failure, a real inability to explain how societal money and government money is really the collection of resources over geography and time. And why that's relevant is because when you properly use those resources over geography and time, you generate far more resources. And that if you get caught up in believing this is a zero-sum game and there's only a finite amount of resources, the only people whose hands you're playing into are those folks who have access to much more resources and trying to keep them from you. And that really, for instance, in the city of Chicago, this $70 million package has a huge return on investment. The reason the United States' economy is zooming at such a much higher rate than every other major industrial economy post-pandemic is because of immigration. The reason major U.S. cities throughout this country have continued to outpace suburban and rural areas in terms of their economic growth, in terms of the average both wealth and income for Black and brown people and people in general versus rural and suburban areas, is because they keep repopulating through immigration and they keep rebuilding their tax base, their property tax base, their sales tax base, and their income tax base. When you have immigration, whether legal or illegal, frankly, it is somewhat exploited labor that supercharges the productivity of a given area, creating economic opportunity for everybody within that area. And when you don't view it as a zero-sum game, when you view building up infrastructure, housing, healthcare, education for everybody, including immigrants, but with the immigrants being able to put certain money into certain areas in the immediate need, those infrastructures, those programs, those structures maintain and continue to exist for everybody else in the community. It's not just a messaging issue about unity between Black and brown folks. It's a messaging issue about understanding how people on the wrong side of the power dynamic can access power and resources and control the levers of power and government better by understanding the dimensions of time and geography in terms of the use of access to those resources. Not to get too far off topic, but I actually had a couple conversations yesterday with a couple local elected officials and a couple non-elected street gang leaders or street organization leaders talking about maybe coming up with a reverse TIF as a way to provide income to the people who get gentrified out of their community once the property values rise, right? That is a creative understanding of how these finances work over time and geography. And if we get caught up in zero sum, us versus them, we harm ourselves and we fail to access the creative and ingenious ways we can control the levers of power for all of us.
Okay, there's a couple of responses that I have. And my first one is like a reverse TIF.
I threw it in there just because you hate TIF. I threw it in there just for you.
Well, I mean, oh my God, don't get me started. You get me, you pushing my buttons here. The TIF program, of course, is intended to eradicate blight and poor low income neighborhoods, and it's largely been used as a force of gentrification.
But the reverse TIFs are created to gather the money that's going to be created in the future to provide subsidies for people who don't need them, like the developers. What if you took neighborhoods that were about to be gentrified and designated an X percentage of future property income taxes, because you know they're about to be gentrified, to then be used to leverage for present day loans and subsidies to the people being gentrified out, to then be paid off by those future tax revenues?
Well, okay. All right, you meant property taxes, not property income taxes. Property taxes, yeah. And because that's TIFs or property taxes. That is like what the TIF program could do as a beneficial program. It'll never happen in a million years because unless we radically change the TIF. It's kind of sort of a little bit what Brandon Johnson is proposing with his housing program, where they close TIFs in upscale neighborhoods, or they haven't specified which neighborhoods would lose their TIFs. And then use the money that flows back to the city hall coffers to borrow money to build low-income housing. That's kind of sort of what he's talking about. And it looks like it's not going to go anywhere in the city council because, and this gets into what you know well because you're a political strategist in Chicago and you've had countless conversations with countless aldermen, Brendan. Aldermen view TIFs as their money. Their ward's money. It's very much that old tribal mentality that's play in the city of Chicago, which is Chicago on one hand condemns and the other hand embraces. Chicago loves its own tribalism. I've never seen a city that's so in love with the notion that it's a gangster city. And so it's like you can't tell an alderman how he or she spends his or her TIF dollars. Those are my TIF dollars. And so then they sign on by having that tribalistic mentality. They sign on to a program that benefits wealthier neighborhoods over their neighborhoods, but they don't care because they got their little piece of the pie, Brendan. That is
but in the reverse TIF idea, they still have control. It's just a difference of who the money's going to. The money's no longer going to to subsidize the developers or people who have money. It's going to subsidize the people who've been displaced or about to be displaced.
Yeah. So then we would need, just follow the thought, just the political dynamic. You would need all the aldermen in the city council to stand up to, let's say, the alderman of the 2nd Ward, Brendan Hopkins, or Brian Hopkins, or the alderman of the 42nd Ward, Brendan Riley.
You can go to Hopkins, Riley, and Conway. I got nothing for you. I'm leaving those three out.
Saying that most of the TIF money that you're talking about redirecting is in their wards. And they'll be howling, this is an outrage. The people, we are the backbone of the city of Chicago. Our people play so much in property that I am outraged, harumph.
No, they don't have a lot of reason to.
So when you talk, and you do talk to a lot of aldermen, when you have your private, you don't have to reveal names and specifics, but just in general, don't you get that response? I've had it many times myself. Like,
so the last couple of years, I don't talk to a lot of aldermen. There's three I talk to kind of regularly. The three I talk to kind of regularly I'm not going to say what they say because there's some people listening to the show probably know exactly who those three are. So let's just leave it. I'm not going to say anything.
All right. Well, just in general terms, I don't know how much we really need some leadership about. I'll just leave it at that on this issue. Chicago's been lacking leadership on this particular issue, trying to get people in black neighborhoods not to view money helping migrants as taking from them or as a threat, a reverse prejudice, if you will. I mean, this rivalry has really undercut progressive politics for the last, I don't know how many years, since Harold died. And we saw it in 2015 when Rahm Emanuel beat Jesus Garcia. It's just been exacerbated. Now I just see it like across the board. It just seems like everybody's against new immigrants from Venezuela. I've Hispanics protest in Hispanic community. It's mine. Go ahead.
Yeah. I remain as optimistic as I did when we first discussed this last summer, last fall. So one, I don't think that the divides are as race-based or ethnic-based as they are perceived. I think there's legitimate principled discussions going on about folks who have been immigrants of many nationalities who've been here for a while and what type of legal authorities and rights they should be receiving if new immigrants receive it. And it was a similar discussion on a much smaller level when the Ukrainian immigrants came. I think there are legitimate conversations happening about what type of investments need to be happening in all of our communities. Again, I don't like the fact that phrase is a zero-sum game and that there isn't a fuller understanding of how some of the economics of government and societal money works, but those are legitimate discussions that should be happening. And again, I remember, I remember when these debates were happening in California in the 90s, and it felt like all of these different communities, Black, Latino, and Asian, were going to end up at each other's throats. And the result was continued conversation, growth, and understanding. And out of conflict comes pain, but eventually comes growth. And I really, I have a lot more optimism that the time we're in now and the zeitgeist we've been in for the last 8 months is actually going to result in a much broader progressive understanding of the value of immigration and the unified ways that various communities can work together. I'm not as pessimistic as you. I think we're just in the moment. And I think you are seeing, not necessarily in public, but behind the scenes, a lot of these conversations happening.
All right. You know what? I want to end the show with a little optimism as opposed to pessimism. So I think that's about as good as ever. And I know, realize we haven't discussed COPA and the whole issue of police relations in Black communities, but which is also a favorite topic of Brendan's when he comes on the show. But I'm looking at the clock, and it's too much to engage in at the at this late hour. So we're just going to have to bring you back to have a fuller discussion about it. Because I know you have a lot of thoughts about the Dexter Reed situation and the COPA investigation and then the fallout against COPA. So why don't we tease it a little bit? Why don't we just tease that particular conversation a bit, Brendan, and we'll close. Try to be optimistic on that front as well.
Okay, well, so the optimistic take is I was around observing when OPS was first created as a young kid and an activist. And OPS was created actually in response to the activism that followed Fred Hampton and then the ousting of Hanrahan. I was actually a lawyer for the last few years of OPS's existence when Lori Lightfoot headed it. I was around as a lawyer when the Abadi incident happened and IPRA was created. I did not see firsthand, either as a young kid around activists, as a reporter for alternative media in the 90s, as a lawyer in the 2000s, during the various iterations of OPS and IPRA, and really during the first couple few years of COPA, I did not see anything from them other than them being a bureaucratic cover-up for police misconduct. I never saw actual accountability from them. And what I have seen in the last couple years from COPA, albeit not as a reporter, not as an attorney, because I've been mostly out of the city for that period of time. But what I've seen in the last couple of years as an outside observer and from knowing some people who are talking to them is there is now a certain level of accountability that's being generated out of them. Not a huge level, not a grand level, but a certain level that didn't exist for the previous 50 years of various accountability entities that have tried to bring, try to reduce police violence. Since you opened the door, let me just say this. We've known since 2017 what reduces police violence and what reduces community violence. We did a ton of work. We had 9 community organizations, BLM Chicago, Network 49, so on and so forth. We worked with those lawyers over at Northwestern who had their students study 23 consent decrees. And when Alexa Van Brunt and Sheila Betty and Craig Futterman and a number of other attorneys and I looked at all of their research, we know what reduces community violence. We know what reduces police violence. And the three easiest things to do is to stop the traffic stops for anything other than a felony violation to take away these rogue tap teams and just to disband them all, and to reduce police and community interaction on petty offenses, to just remove from the criminal books things like loitering, trespassing, and gambling, because these are the things that give bad cops the excuse to constantly mess with young Black and brown folks that end up in more community violence and more police violence. In 2012, there were 20,000 traffic stops in the city of Chicago. The ACLU filed its stop and frisk case. They get it settled. They create a bunch of paperwork making it hard to do street stop and frisk. In 2023, there were 523,000 traffic stops in the city of Chicago. You can't tell me that from 2012 to 2023, there was 500,000 more traffic violations in the city of Chicago. That what you have is rogue tack teams in these SUVs with 3 or 4 guys on coffee, talking to each other, looking for an excuse to stop a black or brown person driving a car, stopping, finding 1% of the time drugs, 0.7% of the time guns, but 99% of the time creating conflict with the community that results in eventual more community violence and more police violence. We know that if you are, if the first time you get stopped by a cop, you actually get arrested and charged and put into the system, you are 17 times more likely to eventually commit a felony in your life, a violent felony in your life, than if the first time you get stopped by a cop, you're not. And we know that out of those 523,000 times of traffic stops, a huge disproportion of those are black and brown men, and that those are the ones who eventually, and then a smaller portion of that are the ones who are going to get stopped and put in the system for oftentimes for a nonsensical reason. We know, we've known since we filed the People's Consent Decree in 2017 how to forget about the accountability, how to prevent the police violence, how to prevent some community violence, and we just aren't doing it.
Wow. What a, have you ever had this conversation with police officers, Chicago police officers, sort of off the record conversations where you just
talking? I've had it with a bunch of retired black police officers who will say, yeah, some will say you're out of your mind. I mean, back when I was much more active as a civil rights attorney, I would get, there was just like in Uptown, you know, with certain people who gave me a hard time growing up, there was certain cops who would find me. I was found once I was found once in a locker room at an export by 50, at the time, like a 55-year-old beefy steroid head cop who wanted to have a real conversation with me. So I've had all sorts of conversations.
Wow. I don't know what a real conversation, you mean like a heart-to-heart
conversation? I've had lots of conversations.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. That could be a whole show itself, the conversation. That could be a play, the conversation. That scene right there in the export gym could be I'm already figuring the dramatizations out of it. But we've run out of time here, and you got a life to get back to. So, Brendan, thank you very much. Always ready to come on my show. And I thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. And we'll talk to you real soon, all right?
Take care.
All right. That's great. Brendan Schiller. I'm Ben Jarofsky. Take care, everybody.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
Hopefully this is the last time you'll hear this ad. Because with Chime checking account features like fee-free overdraft up to $200 with SpotMe and getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit, you can probably treat yourself to an ad-free upgrade to spend more time listening to your favorite podcasts, or at least grab yourself an extra morning latte this month. Join millions of Chime members who work on their financial progress with fee-free overdraft and no monthly fees. When you find new ways to save, you can reach your financial goals easier and still have the occasional treat. Take more control of your finances and say goodbye to monthly fees. Open your account in minutes at chime.com/goals24. That's chime.com/goals24. Chime. Feels like progress. Banking services and debit card provided by Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. SpotMe eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.